everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Really glad you tuned in, and a very happy Tuesday to you. Well, I'm going to tell you a little story. So I want to say it was 12, 13 years ago. I was at a writer's conference, and I met a friend, and we had so much in common. Both of us are named Susan, but she's a grown-up, so she goes by the name Susan. I have not grown up enough yet, so I'm still Susie. But we're both Susans, both blondes, both Harvest House publisher authors, both from Minnesota at the time. I'm talking about Susan Meisner. She's an award-winning, amazing, gifted writer, and she actually will be on the faculty of our writers conference this summer. I've got her on. She's going to tell, just chronicle her journey of how God has led her from one novel to another, from the Christian market to the general market, and she's just such a beautiful, beautiful friend and humble woman of God. And you just have a lot you can learn from this dear girl. So looking forward to having her on. We'll get her on in just a moment. A couple of quick announcements. One of the promotions we've got going this month is a Joy Devotional giveaway. So every day up leading to Easter, Kay Warren has a Choose Joy Devotional. And every single day we're giving a copy away. And she is someone who's just got such compassion and empathy, as someone who's suffered enough in her own right. And she's got some things we all need to learn. I'm telling you, when I interviewed her a year after her son took his life, I wanted to not breathe during that interview because she had such rich wisdom in the midst of her grief. Boy, so grateful to her ministry for offering us these copies. So each and every day. So you have a really good chance of winning. So sign up for free at myfaithradio.com. Also, just to mention the Writers' Conference, it's coming up Saturday, July 15th. We're promoting it now because we still have a limited number of one-on-one appointments left with faculty members. We can accommodate up to, I think, 1,000 people, so we'll be fine that way. But if you've got a desire and a dream to write and you want a chance to meet face-to-face with a faculty member, you want to register right away. We've created a website. It's NorthwesternChristianWritersConference.com. I don't care if you're listening in from the other side of the country, from Florida, from California, where Susan's from, anywhere. This conference is worth coming to because we've got an A-list faculty lined up and great worship. We have Liz Curtis Higgs as our keynote. It's going to be epic, and it's only one day, and it's very affordable. If you want more information, you'll find it at NorthwesternChristianWritersConference.com. Okay, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get her on the show. Susan Meisner is a former managing editor of a weekly newspaper, an award-winning columnist. She's award-winning author of a number of books, and you can find her website, SusanLMeisner.com. Dear Susan, I love you. First of all, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It is such a pleasure to be back.
Love talking with you. So, Susan, you know this. We love to start our conversations talking scripture, and you chose Isaiah 41:10. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you and uphold you with my righteous right hand. Wow, love that. Talk about that passage and why you chose it.
Well, I've always been one to be afraid of things. Even when I was little, I was afraid of, I don't know, just like carousels and going down slides and learning how to ride a bike. I was always very fearful, and I just kind of took those fears with me into my adulthood. I was just afraid of different things. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of being rejected, and so I've constantly had to remind myself that I'm a daughter of the King, and I do not need to be afraid. God is for me. Who can be against me? Those types of things I need constant reminders. So that's a great verse just to kind of keep in my pocket all the time, especially as a writer.
Indeed, indeed. So, Susan, give us a little backstory on your faith journey, how you came to Christ, and what just your faith journey has been like over the years.
I had kind of a curious faith journey, I guess you could say. I was raised in the Catholic Church. My mom took me to Catholic Mass all through my growing up years, and so I was introduced to Christ from a very early age. And then I guess my faith was expanded when I came to know Christ in more of a personal way, I guess you can say, at the age of 16. And I met a wonderful man who I would later marry, who became a pastor. So I've just been able to have opportunities to grow in my faith, probably in ways that I guess I would never have guessed could happen on my own. I've loved being able to grow alongside my husband as he's ministered in the church and learn from him and enjoy all of his great books. I'm a reader, of course, as well as a writer. So it's been great to just immerse myself in the wonderful works of theologians from across all the centuries, and, you know, learning to grow not only in my faith, but in being able to weave in my Christian worldview into my books, which has been a great privilege.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did you first get the inkling that you could write?
You know, sometimes people will ask me, when did I become a writer? And I think what it was is I discovered that I was one. I think it's a gifting that God kind of put inside of me from the very beginning. I guess I was writing poems in my head when I was 4 years old, even before I could write. And so I've always had that itch to write, even when I was little. And it stayed with me through high school, into my college years. And even when I wasn't writing anything, when I was raising our four kids and we were living overseas for a time, still there was always that, I just want to be able to write. And I became a newspaper writer first, but gosh, these stories, novels, were just swimming around in my head. And I finally, in my 40s, decided to go ahead and give novel writing a try. And I really do like it the best. Out of all the different types of writing I have done, I really do like storytelling the very best.
I got to say, and I've said this to you before, I mean, so many of my author friends are novelists, fiction writers, where I'm a nonfiction writer, but where I escape for my joy time is in a novel. I love a good, solid story. And, it's a whole different animal. I mean, I think novel writing is so much more difficult than nonfiction writing. So to jump into writing a novel blows my mind when you think about what it all entails. So I want you to tell the story of you wrote your first novel, how you first, were connected to Harvest House, because this isn't a typical path that a person would take to get published.
No, it was a little different. I think God was just being incredibly nice to me because I really didn't know exactly what I was doing when I wrote my first novel, and I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any connections. And things were a little bit different back then. This was 2002. We didn't have the same amount of availability with the Internet and all of those other avenues that we have now. And so when I wrote my first book, I put a proposal on a website where you can do that. You can put your proposal on a website for your book and hopefully get discovered. And Harvest House just happened to be looking on that website. I don't suppose very many publishers have the time to do that now, but they were that day, and that's how God was able to get me into the door with Harvest House with that very first book.
It's amazing. So that first book, if I remember it, was it Why the Sky is Blue? Is that your first one? Okay.
That was the first one.
Tell us the storyline of that one and the inspiration behind it.
Well, that particular book, it's about a woman who is attacked and she's a married woman, has two children that they were very difficult to conceive. And as a result of this attack, she becomes pregnant. And the subject matter obviously is a little bit difficult, but I keep the reader very cushioned and isolated from the event itself. We don't talk about that in the story, but we do find this woman who loves the Lord and loves her children, and she's pregnant as a result of an attack. And so the story is really about how do you trust God when life hands you something as difficult as that? And then she's got her husband and her other two children, and this predicament that she's in. So really, it was discovery writing for myself on do I really trust God even when something really difficult comes my way? Am I going to stand by what I believe? And so it was much a exercise in coming to terms, like, do I really trust, as it was just a story.
Golly. Okay, so you get your first book published, and I remember the same thing, feeling excited and scared out of my mind. Talk about what that process was like. So you get your first book out there. How did the next book come to fruition? Did your first book do so well that they came back around and said, do you have more for us? Or talk about that process.
Yes, I think that first book did do better than probably anybody would have thought because I was unknown and I really didn't have any kind of connections on my own. In fact, when that first book was about to be published and the publisher asked for a list of influential people that I knew, I could only put Jesus on the list because I really didn't, I didn't know anybody else. And so God was good to me in that respect. That book did pretty well for a beginner debut novel. And so I was able to write 8 more books for Harvest House before I moved on to a different publisher. And I've never felt like those were givens. I've always felt like I've had to prove myself, I guess, with every book that I write. I raise the bar a little higher with each one. I feel like I owe it to God to produce the best form of art that I can because He gave me this gift. And I feel like it's worship even in my little small way with just writing stories, this an act of worship, really, to do the best with the gift God has given you. And I'm very glad that he's blessed that effort so that I'm able to continue writing novels. I think I just, my 18th one just came out. So I feel like I've found my place in the world, that writing novels is probably my wheelhouse, if I could use that image.
I remember when you and I were riding in a van at a conference, and somebody in the van asked if they could ask your advice on how you develop your characters. And that's a significant part of fiction writing, is having really solid characters. I thought it was so interesting. You said, well, one of the things you do, if I remember this right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought you'd said, I interview each of my characters. I want to know what's in their pockets, what's on their hearts, what's in their closet. Say a word about that.
Well, that is entirely true. I do sort of interview my characters. And the thing about characters in a novel, and this is true for any work of fiction that you read, whether it's War and Peace or Green Eggs and Ham, every story is about a character who wants something, and they have to overcome some sort of obstacle to get it. And those are words that I think Donald Miller penned. Every story is about a character who wants something and must overcome an obstacle to get it. And in order for a character to want something, there has to be a reason why they want it. And that's really all the layers of personality, everything that they are going after in the story is because of what they want out of life. And, you know, you look at the story of The Wizard of Oz, and we see Dorothy in the very beginning of the movie, and she's singing about wanting a life where everything is perfect and happy little bluebirds fly. It's because she's, you know, she's an orphan, and she's living on a farm with two elderly family members who maybe don't understand her. So we begin to see from the very, very beginning that what she wants is a life where everything is perfect, because for her, her life seems to be upside down. And so out of that, her layers of personality begin to emerge.
Interesting. Talking to Susan Meisner. She's an award-winning novelist. She's 18 novels now. When we come back, Susan, I want to know. So you said you wrote 8 books at Harvest. When you made the switch, why you made the switch, just some behind-the-scenes kind of insight on what authors go through and why in those cases would we make a jump, and then how you find inspiration for each next book. If you've got questions for Susan, you can email them, Susie@myfaithradio.com, Susie@myfaithradio.com, and we'll be back in a minute. Glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. We have a different conversation today, talking to my friend Susan Meisner, who happens to be on the faculty at our upcoming Writers Conference, Northwestern Christian Writers Conference, taking place this summer. Susan has just released her 18th novel. She's got awards to her name. She's just an amazing, brilliant writer, from my perspective, for sure. And Susan, you can only answer only as much of this as you want, because some of this stuff isn't always for sharing, but just for people who want like an inside scoop of what it's like in the business, so to speak. You'd published 8 books with Harvest House, and then you, I think, was it Waterbrook that you went with after that?
Yes,
talk about that process behind the scenes, as far as how an author decides that maybe it's time to move on, or what kind of goes into that decision.
Well, I think for every author, you're right, it's probably a little different. And when you have an agent as part of your I guess your cheering squad, your agent can help you decide what happens next. And I feel like moving on to Waterbrook was kind of just a step in the direction that I ultimately would go, and that is to write for the general market. Waterbrook is a imprint of Random House, and so it was kind of like my just beginning to feel out the waters of whether or not I had the ability to write for the general market, and is that something that God was going to bless? And so I wrote five books for Waterbrook before I felt like I really did feel like I had the nudge and the approval of God to go ahead and pursue writing for the general market, which is what I did.
And so how did your Christian readers respond to that? You know, so often we can connect dots and make wrong conclusions and assessments and judgments. Were people gracious about that? I mean, talk about that process for you.
You know, I did worry about that when I was making this transition, but it's never come up. So if I have disappointed anybody, they have not come to me and said so. And I'm prepared. I have prepared like my defense. I thought maybe I would have to prepare some sort of defense if I needed to tell somebody, well, this is why I did it. And I can share that with anyone if they're wondering, why did you make that migration? And part of it is the Christian fiction marketplace is wonderful. It's where I got started, and it's a great place for Christian readers to find books that they know aren't going to offend them. You know, the content is such that they're not going to be offended by, you know, profanity and bedroom stuff and all of that. The bad thing, if I can call it that, maybe there's a better word for it, is that because so many Christian writers were writing for the Christian market, there aren't that many, I couldn't find them, writing for the general market, which to me means we've lost a little bit of our toehold there. And so I feel like some of us Christian writers do need to be writing for the general market so that we have some kind of influence there. And so I kind of liken myself to like the book of Esther in the Old Testament, where you've got this amazing story of redemption, but God is never mentioned, and yet there it is in the canon of Scripture. And so, you know, if I was a Christian seamstress, I wouldn't make Christian dresses, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I would just make dresses to the best of my ability, and I would make sure that my business practices were ethical, but the dresses would be for anyone who wanted to buy one. And then when people get to know me, then they find out more about me, that I am a believer. And even though my books aren't faith-based anymore, they're still me. They're written out of me and my worldview. And, you know, your worldview is going to bleed out of you in any kind of creative endeavor that you have. So I don't feel like I've given up so much as I've broadened my ability to reach people with stories that come from my very heart.
And also, there isn't profanity. There isn't. You have not compromised in that regard. You know, sometimes you'll see people do that, and it's a bummer, really. But your book, Secrets of a Charmed Life, talk about that. That was one that you wrote in the general market. It was very highly acclaimed. Talk about that, sir, just so people understand even your niche in the market.
Well, I've been very glad that I haven't had to compromise the way I write to be able to write for the general market. So I'm able to keep the books content-wise, the same as I would have in the Christian market, just without that faith thread being very overt. Secrets of a Charmed Life is about two sisters who are part of the evacuation of London during World War II. And so it's a historical fiction for the most part. And it's a story about, you know, these two sisters and what happens to them during the London evacuation before the Blitz. And both of them will have to come to terms with the fact that we are only responsible for the choices that we make. Sometimes we try to hold ourselves responsible for the choices of others, and really, it's our own choices that we need to, you know, to do our best. And then the rest you have to leave up to, you know, wherever God's going to take you, because there's only so much under our control. And this idea that there are no secrets to a charmed life. There aren't. It's not a secret, and there is no life that is charmed. You know, we live our lives making the best choices we can, with love guiding us at every step, and that's the best that anyone can do. And that's not a secret. It's how we live. It's how life is lived to its fullest.
And the interesting kind of thing, the thread that seems to show up in these novels is you have a historical story going on with a contemporary story. Say a word about that.
I just happen to like that story construction. I did it for The Shape of Mercy, which is probably one of my favorite books, and I wrote it 10 years ago, so it seems kind of old now, but it was the first book that I wrote where I dovetailed a contemporary story with a historical one, and the story at that time just called for it, but I really liked it, and I think my readers liked it, and the publisher liked it, so I realized this might be just my way of writing a story, kind of like my brand, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So for the past 10 years, I've been writing books like that, where I dovetail a contemporary story with a historical one, because I feel like history is still a teacher. It teaches us things. It teaches what we love, what we value, what we're afraid of, what we're willing to die for, fight for, all of those things. And, you know, history speaks to us today in our contemporary world. And so it's not too hard, really, to find two things that kind of speak to each other and have characters on both sides of the timeline, have them matter to each other in one way or another.
Well, Susan, we've got about 2 minutes before our hard break at the bottom of the hour, but interestingly enough, Shape of Mercy was one I was going to ask you about because that was one of my favorites of your books and pretty gripping. Give us the storyline, if you would, on that one.
Well, really quickly, it's about a college student who takes on a job transcribing the diary of a woman who lived during the Salem witch trials. And this college student lives a privileged life, and she thinks she understands human nature pretty well. She's rather... She thinks she's got a good handle on what makes people tick, and she doesn't realize that she has a lot to learn about what makes people tick. And she finds it out while she's transcribing this diary about this young woman who witnessed the Salem witch trials. And really, this is a story about our need to learn that we are first to love people, and then, you know, judging, if we are to judge at all, is the second thing we should do if we're going to do it at all. But our call is to love people, not judge people. And too often we judge first whether or not someone is worthy of love, and that is completely backward. It doesn't ever work out.
And remember, too, this was years ago I read it, but the idea of how quickly we make wrong assumptions and then act on those as if we're in the right, you know. We make judgments based on partial information, and we're so proud of our little bit of information rather than humble about what we might not know, you know.
Very true, yes. And we have a faulty system of going with the crowd. Like whatever the crowd is doing, we kind of just gravitate toward that action. And oftentimes the crowd is wrong.
Boy, talking to award-winning author Susan Meisner. When we come back, Susan, I want to know, what are some common mistakes that novelists make? And maybe some advice for somebody who wants to get their toes wet here and start writing novels. I just love it. Love it. We'll be back in a minute. Tuning in today, I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. Different kind of conversation today. We talk deeper life topics every single day, but really kind of departing a little bit just to talk to my good friend Susan Meisner, who's an award-winning novelist, writer, and she will be on faculty with us at the upcoming Northwestern Christian Writers Conference. In fact, her title of her session is Plotting Your Novels from Start to Finish. So I want to talk some of technique, if we can. First and foremost, what would you say are some of the most common mistakes that novelists who are starting out often make?
Well, for me, when I pick up a novel and I start to read it, if I put it down because I'm not engaged, like I haven't been hooked, I feel like there's a mistake has been made there somewhere. Otherwise, I would want to keep reading. So I think two things that a novelist needs to keep in mind is that what their character wants has to matter to the reader, and there has to be some sort of tension, something that makes the reader turn pages. And if you don't have like good motivation for your character and good sources of tension, that's when a reader either doesn't buy your book or just puts it down, or a future editor perhaps rejects you. And you know, for me, if I want to figure out a good motivation for a character, I just watch a bunch of Disney movies, because honestly, all those old Disney movies, especially the musical ones, every character in those Disney movies starts out by wanting something, and they sing about it. So if you think of The Lion King, the very beginning of that movie, Simba sings about what he wants. He wants to be king. He wants to make his own decisions. So we see right away that he doesn't want everyone calling the shots for him. And then, of course, after his father dies and he thinks he's responsible, he wants to escape the guilt of having killed his father. And so his two desires, they're warring against each other. Both of those things matter. You know, the reader or the watcher, if you will, can understand both of those things because they're universal. This desire to want to be our own person, to be independent, is a universal theme. And so is wanting to escape guilt. We can all understand that. So those motivations are good. And then the tension, of course, is, that's what keeps the reader turning pages is, are they going to get what they want? And little steps forward and victories 1 minute and then setbacks the next minute. There's got to be something at stake. There's got to be some sort of result. If the character doesn't get what they want, what's going to happen? And if the reader can feel that tension, then you've got a plot that will feed itself. It'll generate its own fuel, if you will, by the tension that you provide.
Wow. Which storyline for you, when you look back at your 18 books, are you most proud of?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think today, if you ask me that, I might change my mind tomorrow. But today, I think A Fall of Marigolds is a book that it was my first general market book, was A Fall of Marigolds. And that one is, it's really more than half Ellis Island at the turn of the century during the immigration wave and also 10 years after 9/11 in downtown Manhattan. And the story there is that sometimes we experience a hardship in life and we find ourselves in an in-between place. We can't go back to where we were because that is over. Something has happened. You cannot go back to where you were. And you are afraid to move on to what is next. You can't imagine your life in the future. And so you're kind of stuck right in the middle of this in-between where you can't move forward and you can't go back. And that's no place to live your life. You know, God would have us move forward in faith. But, you know, we've all experienced those times when we feel like we're stuck right in the middle. And Ellis Island was a place that people did not spend too much time. They would immigrate, they would go through the station, and then they would go on to America, which was the place they had longed and dreamed and saved to be. But if you were sick and you could not complete your immigration, you went to the Ellis Island Hospital where you would have to stay until you could be made well. And so that's where the story is set, at this hospital where patients who just wanted to get to America had a view of the Statue of Liberty from their hospital windows, and yet they couldn't. They couldn't complete because they were in between.
Wow.
I liked how that metaphor spoke to me as I wrote it, that the life of faith is taking the step just with the light you have for the moment you have it, and we don't always get a beacon that shows us, 10 miles down the road. It's walking by faith, step by step.
Fantastic. Susan, is your mind always turning a story around? I mean, are you looking for clues constantly, or do they sort of happen upon you?
You know, it's actually a combination of both. Sometimes I'm just living life, doing whatever, and I will see something that will spark an idea or a metaphor that I'll file away for future reference. And then other times, I'm on the active lookout. And the thing is that history is all around us. I like to write historical fiction, so usually there's ample supply of historical events all around. It's just a matter of me keeping my eyes open and my ears open and looking for story in all the different corners and folds of time, because it's everywhere.
It's so true. You know, history still speaks today, and whatever our response to what's happened in the past and what's happening to us now creates a history for somebody else in the future. And so, man, you're so right. You look around, you'll see the threads. And talk about your session at the upcoming Writers' Conference. As much as you're able, just give a little tease, if you would, plotting your novel from start to finish. What can attendees expect when they attend your session?
Well, there's lots of different ways to plot a novel. You can read 10 different books on plotting, and they all might approach it from different ways. But, you know, the basic idea, I think, is probably the same no matter which book you pick up on plotting, and that is you start out on an ordinary day in your character's life. You don't usually start out on the day they're born. you start out on an ordinary day in their ordinary life, and they already have a personality, and you're showing it to us in the pages of your story, those first few pages. And we begin to see what they want out of life, just like Simba wanted to be king. And then something happens, something big that changes everything, like Dorothy's tornado. You know, for Simba, it's the death of his father, and that sets in motion the rest of the story. So you need to have a big moment like that. And then as your character moves through the rest of his quest, there's going to be little victories, like Simba meets two friends, they help him along, little setbacks. When his father speaks to him from the sky and says, "You are more than what you have become." And then, of course, he finds out that, you know, the hyenas have overtaken the Pride Lands. So there's always these little events getting more and more and more accelerated, such that he must go back. He has to go back, or everything that matters to him will be lost. You need to have moments like that, too, in your story. So what you're seeing is this upsweep in what matters and what's at stake. And then, of course, you have some sort of climactic moment where we find out, did the character get what he wanted? And then you tie up any loose ends at the end so that the characters are at a different place, but they're back to that having an ordinary day again, so that your reader can imagine them the day after that, or 2 weeks later, or a year later.
So there's some kind of resolution. You know, I got to know, when you look back at the books, your 18 novels that you've released, would you say that your favorites are the ones that have done the best, or have they been two different piles?
That's so funny. Yeah, I would say, you know, some books I wrote just sort of like almost for fun, because the story idea just appealed to me. Like, I wrote a story called Blue Heart Blessed, and it's actually set in Uptown, just, you know, right near St. Paul. And it's about a gal who gets jilted at the altar, and she tries to sell her handmade wedding dress in a used wedding dress boutique that she opens for that very purpose. And every time someone starts to buy it, she takes it off the rack and can't sell it. So it's really all about this woman who needs to be able to let go of what is no longer hers and trust in love again. And it was a fun little story, and I don't think it did that great. But I love that story. I love how it made me feel when I wrote it, and I just love the idea that there could be a wedding dress shop like that where beautiful gowns are given a second chance at love.
That's so good. Well, it kind of goes to show you, and I've asked that question to many authors, and just know from my own experience, it shows you that our favorites aren't always the ones that appeal to the masses. So I want to know, how do you stay true to your craft and your convictions while at the same time appealing to your reader's taste? Because I feel like that can be a fine line, because you and I've talked about this before. There's times where authors just give me the formula and they do the formula, but they're not really living their true artist convictions, if you know what I mean. Speak to that, if you would.
Well, I think it's a matter of knowing what you want out of your writing career. You know, for some people, it's their job, it's their paycheck. And so they understand the market, and they are writing so that the market will buy their book, and it's almost a means to an end. What's great is when what you love to write and what the market wants, when they align like stars, that's great, because then everybody's happy. If what you want to write is not what the market wants, then you need to adjust your expectations. Write what you feel like you need to write, but just understand that the market may not be ready for it. Maybe it will be later. Or maybe you've written a book that will just have a smaller sales, you know, threshold, and you need to be okay with that, because you went into it knowing that it wasn't the book for the market. It was the book for you. And that's okay. It's okay to write the book for you. But just know who you're writing it for and why you're writing it, and that way you won't have maybe such dashed hopes when this book that you've loved fails to find a place in the market.
You know, another thing too, Susan, is the idea that our identity comes from getting published. When you finally awaken to the dream that, no, this is something I really want to do, this is something I have to do, very quickly we attach our identity to publication and even view people in that same light. How many books you've got published suddenly ups your cool factor, your value, so to speak. I'd love for you to speak to just the idea of keeping our identity intact in the process, but also not selling out too quickly. I mean, some of the authors who I think have done the best had the patience and restraint to not just sign with any small house, but to say, you know, I'm gonna hone this craft. I think I've got something here, and I'm gonna submit myself to a mentor and learn the ropes a little bit. I mean, there's something to be said about that as well. So just talk about that process, our identity, and even having patience in the process.
Definitely, yeah. There's definitely a process involved, and I think if you look at any person who's kind of like the master of their craft, it doesn't usually happen overnight. There's usually a long process of training. You know, Michael Phelps didn't just win all those gold medals by swimming once across a pool. You know, he swam hours and hours and hours, years and years to be able to do what he did in the Olympic pool. And so there is work to be done, lessons to be learned. We need to be able to accept criticism, learn from people whose opinions we respect when they tell us, you know, these are the areas where you need to work. That's all important. So having a teachable spirit and knowing that I'm going to be working on this. I may have the gift of writing, but a lot of times it hasn't been polished yet. And polished comes by swimming laps in a pool over and over and over again. And as far as identity, you know, none of us are identified by what we do. We're identified by who we are. And so if all of a sudden tomorrow I had no more stories to tell, or I could not write anymore because I lost the use of my hands, or I couldn't write anymore because something happened and I no longer have long-term memory, or whatever it is that would keep me from being able to write, that does not keep me from being who I am. I still have something to do. If I were stuck in prison, unable to write, I'm still me. I still have something to say and gifts to give. And so what you create is definitely an outlet of who you are, but it is not who you are. Your identity is always wrapped in who God says you are. And God doesn't usually say, you're a writer. No, he says, you're my child. And that's completely different, and it can never be taken away from you.
Boy, isn't that good news? All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about the importance of writers' conferences. I know Susan's an advocate, as am I, what you can expect, advice for somebody who's an aspiring author who's listening today. That's you, Cassie. I know you're listening. Talking to Susan Meisner, award-winning writer. She's just a brilliant writer. Real. Check out her novels. We'll be back in a minute. Hope you're having a really great day today. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. If you listen often enough, you know we are always plunging into deeper life topics, and we love to live there. We're talking different, a little bit departure today for a very distinct purpose. We've got an amazing writers' conference coming up. It's our first of what we pray will be annual, and I just really believe this is going to become one of the anchor Christian writers' conferences in the country, and it really is shaping up that way. We've got A-list faculty coming in. Liz Curtis Higgs is our keynote speaker. Amazing worship plan. Registrations are pouring in. And the thing about it is, I mean, I've dropped as much as $1,000 to go to a writer's conference. This is one day only, $150 to attend. It really is just an epic, amazing opportunity. And on with me today is my good friend Susan Meisner, who's a multi-published author, written in both the Christian market and the general market. And we were talking a little bit about, just now, if we could, Susan, about writers' conferences. I know you're a huge advocate, as am I, and I want you to just talk about the importance of attending a writers' conference. It's often the first piece of advice we'll give somebody who wants to be published.
Mm-hmm. It is. I think the best thing about conferences is it places the writer in their world. Writing is very isolating. When I write, I'm alone in my house. I don't have coworkers. There's no water, you know, cooler. There's no one really to talk with because I don't have coworkers. And so when you go to these writers' conferences, it really is like going to a convention of other workers just like you. And so there's a lot of synergy and symmetry in being with like-minded folks like that. You learn from each other, grow from each other. You are able to avail yourself of great teaching, unparalleled teaching, and then being able to meet with editors and agents is something you just cannot do in any other forum. This is the way to be able to pitch your idea, your book proposal, your chapters, whatever you are working on, to agents and editors who are looking for new writers. And so I can't say enough good things about writers' conferences.
So what would an attendee expect? How should they prepare?
I think the best thing to do is to go with the idea that I'm there to learn. I'm not there to get published. If you're ready, if you feel like your project, your work in progress is ready, that might be your desire to get a contract, but that's way out of your control. You know, it may be the time for that to happen, may not, but you can learn. That is something you can control, is what you will get out of the conference. And so I would say go with the idea that I'm here to learn as much as I can. You know, trust the process, that if now is not the right time, that the right time might be coming, maybe not now, and you might get some really good advice for making the next time you go to a conference, you know, the right time for your work to get discovered. And then just make friends. These are going to be your coworkers again. The people that you meet at conferences can, just like you and I met, Susie, at a conference. These are people that could turn out to be your lifelong friends and coworkers in your craft. And so I would say be teachable, make friends, and be flexible with what happens.
And so if you are teachable and you're flexible and you're willing to apply yourself to the craft and you get yourself to Writers Conference and then you get yourself to another one, it's so interesting, as you say, you get to know these different friends and we're in different lanes, so to speak, but we can encourage each other. Interesting, too, for me, as I look back at some of these people that I met when you and I met about 12, 13 years ago, a number of these people that kept showing up eventually got published. I mean, you're not even too surprised to see it happen because they're applying themselves and they're showing up. And I just think there's wisdom in that. And not to say it can never happen any other way, but this is the widest lane, I would say, for taking next steps to get published, wouldn't you?
Oh, I totally agree. I think most of the friends that I have met over the years that started out like me, not really having any kind of into the industry at all, became published because they went to conferences and they didn't go just once. They went often, and kind of counting those conferences as kind of like continuing education, investing in their writing career by going to conferences so that you can build on those experiences and all the while you're polishing your work to get it ready for the day when it is ready for publication.
It is amazing, too. In a number of these workshops, you'll have a chance to do some practical application. You do the Q&As, and so we've got the one-on-one faculty appointments, which are limited, but there's also something called the Pro Advice Room, and different faculty will be stationed there where you just stand in line and you'll get a good 10 minutes or so where you can ask your questions or bring your writing in and have someone critique it and look at it. So it's an amazing opportunity. I have a question for you about platforms. How have you navigated the pressure of building a platform, Susan, without, one, selling your soul, and two, draining yourself dry? Because you and I have seen that over time as well, where someone wants it so bad that they drive themselves right into the ground or maybe compromise just something that's not sustainable for them. How have you managed to navigate those waters?
Well, for me as a novelist, I have realized that my platform is just I must tell a good story. I'm not writing on a nonfiction topic where my platform is that topic about which I speak and perhaps have a degree in that kind of thing. So my goal is to write a great story. And so I don't often get, you know, invitations to come on television or radio to speak on a topic because my topics change from book to book. So I would say for the novelist, your goal is to tell a great story and let the platform be you. You are the platform. It's you as a storyteller. If you're writing nonfiction, I think your platform is what you care about. It's what you're passionate about, and it's good to have a single-minded passion. I think if you're passionate about a lot of things, it's really kind of hard to I think it's actually hard to be passionate about many things. Usually your passion is what you're willing to suffer for. That's what the Latin word passion comes from, is to suffer. That's why we call the week of Easter the Passion Week. So your passion should be something that matters to you more than anything else, and it's about which you write and speak about. And so your platform should matter to you. No matter what happens to you in the publishing arena, your passion won't change because it's what you care about.
Hmm. You know, my boss is a former pastor. He still operates as a pastor to me, I feel. But he said, you know, nonfiction authors and And speakers and pastors all basically have 2 to 3 messages. You know, if you look at all of the messages, they kind of boil down to that. I would say the passion, and I guess you could even transfer that to your brand. We've not loved that word over the years, but there is something that identifies you, you know. For me, I would say fighting the good fight of faith. I mean, nothing has come easy to me, and just learning how to grapple with the promises of God and stand in the battle, that pretty much weaves into everything I talk about. And so that would be kind of my lane. And I think it is wise, isn't it, Susan, to just figure out, you know, where you've come, what God is doing, and what's sustainable. What, like you say, what you can suffer for, even because you know it's something God has called you to.
Yeah, I think if we think too much about branding as a marketing term, it begins to seem mercenary and maybe not quite, it doesn't fit right with maybe our persona or vibe. It certainly doesn't for me. But if I think of my brand as just, how do people know me? Like, when people think of me, what do they think of? That's my brand. And so I want them to think, she writes historical fiction, and sometimes she writes historical fiction with 2 storylines. So that may be my brand in the marketing place, but really it's just how people will remember me in a sea of other writers.
Boy, that's good. Well, appreciate so much you coming on. I know you're busy, busy gal, and I look forward to seeing you here in just a few months at our upcoming Writers Conference. Wondering if you pray specifically, Susan, for that young woman listening today who's got a dream to write. She's got a blog. She's taken her first steps, but she looks up and sees the sea of writers and feels like, maybe I'm crazy. Would you pray for her listening today?
Sure. Father God, I just pray for everyone listening who feels the call to express their thoughts and desires in words, and you've given them that desire, and because it comes from you, you have a purpose for it. And perhaps it's not clear yet what that purpose is, but if we seek you out, we will find you. I just pray that you would give each person listening the sense of peace and calm, that you are not far off and you are not distant, and you are right here in the fray, helping us, shaping us, molding us, and preparing us for the good work you have for us to do. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Susan, thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
God bless you, dear friend. Well, you've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. In just a bit, you'll find a podcast of today's program up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Remember this, too. The Lord wants you to last long and finish strong, and He is the one who'll keep you strong to the end. Walk with Him. He's got you. We'll meet you back here next time.